conversation partners today are Carl Kosart, professor of the New Testament, and Zdravko Stefanovic, professor of the Old Testament. And we are all three colleagues and still friends in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
The title of our lesson is David and Bathsheba, Adultery and After. Now, David is referred to in the New Testament as someone who God called a man after my own heart. But there is an exception. One and a couple of incidents, actually, in David's life that Scripture points out as failures. And perhaps the most spectacular, at least the one that we are most familiar with, is David's adultery with Bathsheba. He is out on his palace roof, and he spots a beautiful woman bathing, Bathsheba. The fact that she is married does not deter him. And although he already has six wives, at least, and countless other concubines likely, he takes Bathsheba and commits adultery with her. How could such a man ever be considered a man after God's own heart?
It's a difficult question to ask. You look at David's whole life and you see a person whose heart was open and willing for God, yet a man who could step so far away. If this one event, to look at it in isolation, I would think that would not be a true phrase. You just look before and look after. Although the consequences for this act in David's life are severe, it affects his family in a great way. But we see an openness in the end of the story, and I don't want to get there too soon. David is willing to accept, in the end, his responsibility.
I don't want to sound this to sound too simplistic, mm-hmm. but when we look at 2 Samuel chapter 11, again, we have a story where God's name is absent. David is doing something that definitely wouldn't please God, but he forgets God.
Became very comfortable. The text is interesting in verse 1. At the time when, in the spring of the year, when kings would go out to war, but this king staying home enjoying the creature comforts of his palace life.
And then at the very end, the closing of the chapter says, you know, because David thought that nobody knew what was going on and so on, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. This is clearly not a high point in David's walk with God. In fact, it is a low point. Now, the adult Sabbath school study guide looks at David's multiple wives as an indulgence of his passions and suggests, and I'll just read a quotation here from them, and I wonder if this is true or false, if you agree with this. Quote, "The indulgence of a passion, far from removing the passion, only makes that passion stronger and stronger." Is that true? Or is it true only of some passions, but not others?
I don't see that really. I don't see very much evidence of that in David's life, except for this incident. In fact, his previous marriages could rather be considered as positive. And David showed on more than one occasion that he was a man of integrity and so on. And this would certainly be an exception to it. Mm-hmm. And I would be very hesitant to generalize now that to apply to his whole life and to make big deal out of it. This was a moment when David made a mistake. We might be tempted now to moralize and so on, but to me, the simple fact that he lost sight of the Lord probably might be the key to the mistake.
And I think the main issue is an issue of self-control, which everyone struggles with, and put in a position of power. He did not have a sense of self-control, which he should have had. That would have solved the whole problem here, but he did not have that.
Did Bathsheba have a choice?
Yeah. What was her role in this whole affair? Pun intended, I guess.
Yeah.
Was Bathsheba without blame?
It's interesting because, of course, Nathan says to David, "You are the man." But she is really very quiet in this story, and I think we painted her often as an innocent victim who is manipulated by this king. But in an affair, it seems to me that takes two to tango, although he is the king. Obviously she apparently did not try to resist.
Could you have done something to stop the kind of cycle that ensued? First there's the adultery, then there's the attempt to cover up, yes. And then ultimately the murder, and then a death of a child as well as a part of this.
She could have at least tried. We don't want to be too hard on her, but thinking of the risks involved, in Joseph's case, he suffered because of the consequences of his choice. And Joseph, according to the rules of his time, he deserved to die because of the false accusation, and he did not die. The Lord may have intervened through Potiphar, who had known him, and in this instance too. I also find a contrast in the story between Uriah's loyalty to his people, to his land. In fact, he was a foreigner, Hittite, and yet, you know, his loyalty toward the army in which he was serving, and his king and his fellow soldiers, versus David, the anointed one,
and perhaps Uriah's wife.
Yeah.
An issue of loyalty as well.
Yes.
And once again, that is, Scripture is silent on the role of Bathsheba in the account. So we all could do is we can speculate. So.
If we were to talk about adultery, though, in our day, it is the case, isn't it, that we often try to figure out who's to blame. Is that a helpful thing to try to decide? Are both offending parties equally guilty, or is there sometimes a more innocent party when it comes to adultery?
I don't know how easy it is to generalize. Most likely there are a number of scenarios and so on. What we can say about this instance here, again, this is probably subjective, but Bathsheba could have done something to prevent this somehow.
Okay. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that trying to figure out who to blame is where we should spend most of our energy, even today. And unfortunately, it seems to me that's often what we try to do. I'm not sure that's helpful. May not have been helpful then, and may not be helpful for us today. Now, following the sin and the cover-up, which resulted in death, the Lord does not just turn away from this, but sends a message to the prophet Nathan. And Nathan tells a parable to David, and through that enables David to essentially pronounce judgment on himself. Describe that kind of setting. What happened with Nathan? What did he tell David? And what might we
do? That's a wonderful story. As Nathan comes in, you kind of visualize this. He says, there's this tragedy that's happened in our land. There's a man who has so much. He has these lambs, tons of lambs. And there's this one man in this home, and all he has is one little lamb. And this other wealthy, landowner or whatever, takes that one little lamb and uses that, to eat and to use. And Nathan says, this is a scandal. And David says, well, this is wrong. The man, should lose his life who would take that one little lamb, that the person, the lamb he cared for and tended like his own child. And then he says, you are that man. So David does pronounce judgment upon himself that, that man should die. Yet, what's interesting in the story is David does not die. It's his son that pays the price.
Yeah, it's both interesting and also disturbing at the same time. That David's response is beautiful there at the conclusion of that parable, which parable of judgment, which Nathan proclaims. How does David respond? No excuses. Oh well, hey, she was bathing there on the roof, or he confesses, acknowledges his sin.
No hostility either.
And Nathan tells him that, that harm would not come to him, but that the child that was conceived would die. I don't mean to continue to ask questions that are difficult to answer, but how do we relate to that? David sins, and yet it is his child who dies.
You asked first for David's response, which is, I have sinned against the Lord,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting because this is the same kind of situation that happened with Joseph. And he says, how can I do this great thing and sin against God? So he views it not simply in, you know, a horizontal sense, mm-hmm. but he sees the vertical connection to this as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is ultimately it's before God. So that's his answer, first of all. Why that child dies? Yes, this is a difficult question with no easy answer. Scripture does not say. This is the only place in Scripture really where there is some sort of death or, you know, illness really associated with it being caused by the sins of the parent. Other place, John chapter 9, verse 2, where they ask Jesus, you know, who sinned, you know, this man or his parents? And Jesus says, that's not the question. This is for the glory of God. So this is a difficult passage for us for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, there's a variety of answers. One answer being that the reason that the child dies is because although David and Bathsheba's sin was secret in a sense, this makes it public in a very mm-hmm. public way. Of course, if David would have died, it would have been public too.
Mm-hmm.
I know also some people who would say that what David did, he willingly placed himself and Bathsheba on the enemy's territory. And we know that the enemy is swift to take away lives and to destroy. And, you know, the child did was a product of a sinful, union. And yet that child was still innocent, mm-hmm. we are mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. However, there is a good news, and that is that, once David married Bathsheba, and they have a child, that child becomes very famous, King mm-hmm. Solomon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that child as King Solomon, the second child born right, to yes. David and Bathsheba. It's interesting to me that in this story, David and Bathsheba name their child Solomon, but the Lord gives Solomon another name, mm-hmm. which I think is significant. And that name is Jedidiah, right?
Jedidiah. Mm-hmm.
Which means?
Loved by the Lord.
Loved by the Lord. That says something to me about, again, the Lord's working with not an ideal situation, mm-hmm. far from it, and indications of his continued presence with David and even his blessing mm-hmm. Of David and Bathsheba. Well, we've come to the end once again. There's much more that we could have talked about, I suppose, but thank you, Zdravko and Carl, for your participation today. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and finally, thank you for listening in. For Good Word, this is Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.
What do you get when you take one weak-willed king and add to him a power-hungry and conniving woman? Welcome to Good Word, a weekly radio program which explores issues of faith. Our current series focuses on Old Testament.